his point of view too, which was that he wasn't backed by government or by university, and so he needed to make a profit on what he was doing in order to keep on what he was doing.
The main thing he saw was the difference that this technology would have on the development of the AI industry and how it could really develop his business. Looking at the spread of American Breeder Service, selling seamen across the whole of America. I remember at that time the slogans were, you know, the whole of the United States, and every sow proved great and so forth. This was the slogans on which they worked, and their principle was to have ABS technicians operating in all states of America.
Mm-hmm.
The idea of being able to do this was possible with frozen semen.
And only possible with frozen semen,
right.
Yeah.
So, although in Great Britain, where we developed the technology originally, shown that it could work, it was a bit slower coming on because Britain's a small country, ordinary liquid semen was being used fairly effectively.
Mm-hmm.
Short distances to travel, you didn't have to keep it for very long. There was a slower take-up of the technology than there was by ABS. Gear was a great... So Rock did a great thing in promoting this development. And as I said in my talk, the development of the liquid nitrogen storage container made the practicality of this thing far more than it was previously.
Yeah.
So those are two very important things that that Rock did. I remember when he was interested in getting the Linde company to develop these liquid nitrogen containers, he would constantly be on the phone and say, can you freeze the sperm down to those temperatures? In Britain we didn't have liquid nitrogen, we had liquid air, which is roughly the same sort of temperature. But in the States, where you're having, you know, all this development of neon signs and advertising and things, there was a big industry in the liquefaction of the gases and the getting off the rare gases and things to use in these different ways. So liquid nitrogen was becoming a byproduct.
Mm-hmm.
Which wasn't the same in Europe in those early years after the war. So we were using liquid air, which is a very dangerous substance. You can get very bad explosions with liquid air. And so it had never envisaged using liquid air as a routine storage thing. We'd shown that the sperm could be subjected to that temperature without any problem.
Mm-hmm.
So that was of an interest to apprentice.
But nitrogen is fairly inert, isn't it?
It's very safe.
Yeah,
so that's why it's so good.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why these liquid nitrogen containers are used throughout medical and biological research now, for storing all sorts of tissues and cells. Very widely used.
Well, in my my early notes, and in, I started actively taking notes in 1967, and my own memory, what I had down about this particular era was that as soon as Rock heard about this calf over there, which I hadn't understood about the chicken business, so I just heard about the calf, that all of a sudden here was a frozen calf over in England, and so he promptly sent Willett over. And when I met with these men last a year ago Christmas, not Bartlett but Sullivan and Walton and Dietrich, they were dubious about that. They didn't think that. They said, no, Chris Polge came over here, Willett didn't go over there. Well, then I got poking around.
Somebody
and
came over.
Yeah.
I didn't know if it was Rock or Willett, but somebody had definitely been over before that.
Mm-hmm. Well, this was what I figured, and so I called up a man. Mm-hmm. I found Harlan Cook's name on some...
It would have been late 52 or early 53.
Mm-hmm. Well, seeing as how we had a calf in 53, it probably was 52.
Right.
It was probably right after they found it. And I had understood that Willett came over. And so I called up Harlan Cook, whose name I found in my papers, and he had written Dad some letters, and he was from the same era, and I knew he was working up there from the documents I had, which are not in great order, but I have learned more and more to put them together. And so I got him on the phone, and I said, did or did not Rock send somebody over there? He said, oh yes, he sent Willett right away. And so I figured, well, that's exactly what Rock would have done, was to have sent Willett right away. And then when I talked to you, you said, well, you thought maybe he came himself.
I couldn't remember and that. I remember Louis coming, because Louis was involved in some of the very early work and written his book, Life and Death of Great Abbotson. So he was a much respected man. Was Louis.
And I heard all those stories because my father found him a very colorful character. And apparently at that when you came over, there was a conference in Chicago.
That's the one I was talking about.
And that's the one where I think my father told me about it, where Louis gave a talk.
One of the things that I was over at that time, and I knew Louis. Louis regarded me as a respectable scientist, carrying out science for science's sake, low temperature biology. The fact that I was working with ABS at that time, Rock was able to use that as a bait to bring Louis to this meeting. And because Louis really wasn't very interested in insemination, particularly coming from the background that,
that he was,
he did. So he was interested in sperm as cells and viability.
Would he have been involved in the unnaturalness of it, that one should not do this? You wouldn't.
That didn't seem to bother
that
him.
That didn't bother him.
He wouldn't be doing things for the promotion of artificial insemination, its application. He was interested in the pure science. What happens to living matter when it's exposed to low temperatures. And in fact, in some ways, Louis had put back some of the developments in cement freezing that we were able to demonstrate, because Louis's concept...
By put back, do you mean put behind, or...?
There's a saying that the greatness of a scientist can be measured in how far back he puts progress in his time. Because people, if they're a great scientist, people believe their hypothesis and thesis. And sometimes, because of this great belief in what these people say, they don't question. So you have to have questioning minds to all great scientists, and that's where progress is made. We fell upon the protective action of glycerol and so forth by accident, so it wasn't our questioning mind. It was a chance.
Well, that's the story I've got in there, where you went off to the pub and...
That's a different story.
That's
not the important
action. The first one was the glycerol, where you found something was much more motile. Is that the word I want? That was still living. And then...
No, we got some mislabeling of the bottles. It's recorded in a... you haven't got that reprint. It's recorded in the last NAAB 1968 proceedings, where I was talking about what led up to the development of
the 1968 proceedings of the NAAB. That's the glycerol story. I've got it in here, but it's probably garbled somewhat. It was the mislabeling of the bottles, right? So you had to reanalyze. What was the medium that these sperm were in?
Anyhow, Louis was a great man, and but I say his very big basic science. His thesis was that by partially dehydrating cells and cooling them very, very rapidly, you could stop water crystallizing and turn it into a vitreous state, which is a glassy state, not crystalline. And so most of the attempts to freeze living cells have been using ultra-rapid freezing. And that is very damaging to the majority of cells. They won't withstand that, and you can't freeze fast enough to get vitrification. So it was the use of glycerol as a fire protective agent, and the development of a slow freezing process, which we used for bull sperm, that completely changed the course of the concept of the conservation of living cells at very low temperature.
And so that
if
was
if we'd been following the sort of Luyer principles, we would never have frozen the bull sperm at the rate that we found best.
You were doing it fairly slowly, but then when you had your night at the pub, you discovered it could be a lot slower yet, with better results. Wasn't that it?
It didn't change the rate so much. It just changed the number of sperm that survived.
The equilibration period. Okay, that was
affected the cells and gave them a greater resistance to.
So there were more that survived.
Yeah.
Okay, well then that clears that spot up then.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
So when Luyer came to work at the foundation, I don't think he made any major contribution to the development of any of the technology for sperm freezing. In fact, I think Luyer's main productive life had been before his time at the foundation.
Mm-hmm.
He enjoyed his time here. And as you say, he was bribed with his microscope and his wonderful machinery.
And his telescope.
Yeah.
On top of his house on the shores of Lake Mendota.
That's right.
Uh-huh.
So it was the lure of mammon that brought him there. But I think that scientifically, probably his best work was done in St. Louis.
And then, as my father said long ago, he wasn't that eager to return to Switzerland and his monastery when his academic stint was finished.
Shouldn't think he was.
And,
I wonder the rock didn't give him the house and he could retire from being a priest.
Well, I think he did. I think that he finished his days in Madison. I don't think he ever went back to Switzerland.
Right.
And so that... well, then... When you read this, did you say anywhere, oh no, that's all wrong?
It's just the lead up to it, the chronology was wrong
in relation to the
glycerol story and why Willett had been freezing, trying to freeze sperm, because that was the space between the success that we've got with the chicken sperm.
Mm-hmm. Well, then what I should do is throw in that this was going on in England and that there had been chicken...
I'll give you that reprint.
From 1968 that gives the... I'd like that, yeah. Because then I could clear that up and then it would also indicate why when suddenly Rock discovered that you were on to bull sperm that...
That's what brought me here. There'd been some work going on, semen had already been frozen by ABS. But they wanted me to come and help them build it up quickly and do some more development. I came originally for a month.
Well, you see, Willett would have gotten something from you when he came over, and then he would have come back and continued working on it, but then they wanted you too.
But as I say, he wasn't the guy I was working with.
Turned out to be working with Dunn.
Dunn, and... Willett was just in the... He was carrying on with his embryo transfer.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, that's... I need to clear that up with Dave, but I think that I've got that all down somewhere.
Dave was around that time.
So he was the one that...
He's dead now, of course. He might have known, but he was only just arriving in...
Elliot, yeah.
In Madison at that time.
I had not... When they took this book... At Northwestern, they said, you know, how close is it to being done? I said, I have two great big pieces that are still in process. And one was the corn and the other was the artificial insemination that I had in lots and lots of pieces on it. And so it wasn't only until last Christmas, a year ago Christmas, that I took that time and started putting all that stuff together. And it was, if I'd done it a year or two sooner, I would have gotten Elliot. But Elliot had just died. And he would have been invaluable in knowing what had gone on, and probably in stories about Rock Prentice too.
I was saying that, as far as Rock was concerned, he invited me over, and had agreed to come and work for a month at that time. So I stayed at the Edgewater Hotel since very much. I used to go to the lab every day, and also had an opportunity to travel around and visit some other universities in the vicinity as well. But they persuaded me to stay for another month, so I stayed a couple of months. And that involved me staying over a bit. I remember spending Thanksgiving with Prentice. It was only Rock and his wife. And this was in an apartment in Chicago, looking out over the lake someplace. It could be, no, that wasn't the time. That photo I showed of me and Rock, I was wearing a label. It must have been when I was at one of those meetings that we had. And I stayed on drinking with Rock, and that's during the time he was trying to persuade me to come and work for ABS. I was engaged to get married at that time and wanted to do so much more in the UK, and the research opportunities are far wider than the UK, working for ABS, and no, the money probably, but we weren't very well paid as young scientists in the UK. Money might have been useful. However, I remember with Rock having several drinking sessions with him, and he thought that if he could get me drunk enough, he could get me to agree to come and work for ABS. One time, it must have been during the time I was staying with them over Thanksgiving, we must have been out to a bar someplace, and pretty late at night, we were coming back, and I think Rock liked a bit of a gamble, and he bet me that, you know, a bunch of keys and stuff, but I couldn't find the key to the apartment within 3 tries or something. And by matter of chance, I opened the door, I found the right key, so I won that bet. I forgot that. I think I got a hat. He was wearing a hat. In this windy city, you have to wear a hat. And I had this old Rockefeller Prentice hat at home for some years after that. I think it ended up on a Guy Fawkes or something like that. Always reminded me of Rock. But he did used to like his little parties.
He didn't get you so drunk that you gave in. You were able to out-drink him.
I had a pretty good resistance to alcohol. He wasn't really able to get me drunk enough.
Well, that's a fun story, the one about the key and ending the hat ending up, the Rock's hat ending up on a Guy Fawkes. That would be fun to stick in. If you don't mind, I'll stick that one in and see if it fits.
Right. I can't then if I remember many more Rock stories. I had plenty, but you know, I wasn't really very close to him as a man. He used to be at a lot of these meetings.
I think it was probably hard to get close to him.
Yeah. They were pretty keen. I mean, I remember it was interesting to me to see that, you know, the reporting back on the progress and things when I was working at ABS was far stricter than the freedom that we had in research in my own laboratories, where we were our own guests. We decided what we wanted to do, and we did it in our own time. And we worked very diligently in long hours. But with ABS, it was a pretty well worked out program. We used to report back discussions with people like Phil Avery and others on the progress that we were making, and getting the application of the freezing.
Bartlett told me that Lier ran his shop, Uwe, in an old German style or Swiss style, whatever, which is that everybody had to report into him every night what they did.
No surprise.
And then there was one place here, I think it's in the dark print, where I was checking somebody, where I was questioning some of the things that they told me that didn't seem to agree with everybody, and I think it was Bartlett that said, well, he did keep their feet pretty close to the fire, was his term. So that would be what you're meaning, that he kept
prodding away in the background, yeah.
That he was keeping track and pushing and so that would be a bit different than between the private industry and the university, where there's more free inquiry and where it might lead. That he was pushing towards an object.
Yeah, and it's a very clear object, and I say that's the strength of the rock to get this technology applied.
Mm-hmm.
And in many ways, went faster through the ABS system than it did. Certainly, the biggest organisation in Britain was our Milk Marketing Board, which owned most of the AI centres.
Mm-hmm.
And they took about 10 years to get frozen semen on their own. In the States, it's gone much quicker.
Yeah. Bill Bartlett said that Rock was about 2 years ahead of everybody else, ahead of the universities and government.
Through this push that he had.
Through.
And the use of the nitrogen containers.
Mm-hmm.
They worked really, really well.
Yeah. Although he had asked for a 2-year head start on the nitrogen, and then they had a strike. So he really only had about a 9 months head start on the...
That's right, because after that 2-year period, some of the people from Lindy, I suppose they were from Lindy, left and formed Minnesota Valley Engineering. And they were producing liquid nitrogen flasks using the super insulation.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty quickly.
Yeah, well, he didn't patent that. He just asked for the 2 years and didn't quite get it.
But he did give the money for the development.
Yes,
didn't he?
Yes, he gave the money to do it.
Yeah.
And probably the vision too, saying, look, here's what we want, and here's how, you know, you figure it out, but here's what we want.
Yeah, they were specifically going for containers for distribution of sperm. I don't think people envisaged the far widest medical and biological applications at those times for that type of technology.
Mm-hmm. But now it's all over the world, everywhere, all the medical stuff.
You can't go into a lab without seeing a nitrogen container,
mm-hmm.
using basically the same sort of, previously everything was in these thermos supplies. The idea of using vacuum, a vacuum layer for giving you insulation is an old one. And what Lindy did was to increase the insulating power by developing this super insulation which they put into this vacuum layer. And that gave them much higher insulation which protected the liquid nitrogen at this very low temperature from boiling off.
Mm-hmm. What was the word you used? From boiling off?
Boiling
off, yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I'm wondering if there's anything more in here that deals directly with where was it?
One of the things when I read through your, I was rather reminded of that story I was saying when people's concepts that they hold to can put back progress. Even in the mid-1950s, we in the United Kingdom and a lot of European countries, I don't think we're very impressed with indexing system that was being used for the bulls, and with this idea of the, using a proven bull on the basis of where its daughter's better than its mother. Our geneticists had already realized that this was a very poor type of index, and had developed systems for bull testing. It's called the contemporary comparison system, in which you use a group of young bulls mated to a large number of females on different farms.
Isn't this what Walton was working on and
he came up with a formula? He came to it much later.
He came later.
Later than people like Robertson in the UK, that was already establishing these sorts of things over there. And I remember thinking that if ABS persist in this sort of so-called proven bulls, they're going to come unstuck, because it's not really a very effective problem with this. And I know that people at ABS will realize this and were really worried, because they used to wait for the national records that were published to see how their bulls would come out in comparison with other bulls being used.
Well, then what either Walton or Bartlett told me was that they were so impatient with the government, because the government was so slow, that Rock financed upgrading their computers so that they could get the information sooner. And then once the information did come through and was showing that they were on the wrong track, that then he was a big enough man to say, okay, let's do it right then.
What's the way to do it right? That's really a very good thing, because for somebody to throw over a concept on which the whole thing has been built and based up.
And especially that his father, with his father keeping him...
That's right.
I mean, for him to cross his father and get rid of the Mount Hope Index and the whole thing, and start, and they dropped the slogan, no longer every bull proved great, because they weren't all proved great anymore.
That's right. Well, none of them had a proof, really, what we would talk about as a proof. To get a proven bull, you'd need a lot of daughters tested and a progeny testing.
Yeah. You mean the old ones that were proved great didn't have that and enough daughters?
They didn't have enough daughters. They didn't have enough spread across different farms, across different environmental systems and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
So it could all be skewed by environmental factors.
Well, this was the way Walton explained it to me. He's a very strong, dynamic sort of guy to talk to, and I tried to get it straight from him, and I think I might have gotten it close to it. Anyway, he's been over this a lot, and so have the others. And all this, the scientific stuff that I've put in, I tried to sift it through what I understood and make it readable. And of course, it'll probably depend finally on Northwestern, how much of that they use. My editor said he'd skimmed a little of that. But here, I've got Henry Dunn here. Let's see.
I saw that you mentioned him one time.
Yeah, and I asked the man, where did he come from? And
he had come from Cornell.
Everything okay here?
Yeah.
I wonder if I might have a napkin, please.
Sure.
Oh, wait, no, I've got one here on the floor. I don't need it. I just knocked out my contact lens by mistake.
Oh,
and I just want to be sure I don't lose it, so I can put it back.
Can you see
I can see fine. I could put it back, except that...
You'd infect your eye, maybe.
Well, no, I just don't want to bother to do it at the moment. As long as I can put it in a safe place, then I can put it back when I have a moment, but I don't want to interrupt talking with you to put a contact back. Let's see, if I stick it in there, it's perfectly safe. There.
Remember where you put it.
Oh, yes. Although my memory is getting awfully bad these days. So, but I think somewhere in here, at least I understood at one point when I was talking with the man about what happened with Dunn coming And that because I was finding these articles, it was talking about Dunn all of a sudden, and they weren't talking about Willett anymore. And this article, for instance, in Hord's Dairyman, that we're talking about the calves due from frozen semen, and he was the spokesman from ABS, and he was the one that was involved in it all.
Yeah.
And
53, probably in the 68 when I was over during that time in 67, 68, mm-hmm. we probably visited him there. He went back to the veterinary school. He came from the veterinary college at Cornell, not the animal science. And he went back to work on cytogenetics, I think, chromosome structure.
And after
he had his wife, unfortunately, was alcoholic, so he had a very unhappy, difficult time at home. And he's vanished. He vanished off the research scene. I don't know what really happened to him at all. He certainly didn't stay in the area of semen preservation and freezing at all. So I think he was only a relatively short time with ABS.
Well, Dave Bartlett might remember. He's got a sharp...
I didn't think John Sullivan would, because
John came too late on the scene.
He came too late, yeah. Mm-hmm. And anyhow, when he came, he was more interested and involved in horse sperm and things.
Mm.
I remember John Sullivan one time came to England with his wife and for a scientific meeting. He got dreadfully ill, huge pains in his abdomen. So we rushed him into hospital and they diagnosed kidney stones. So he had to stay in hospital for a bit. We had his wife to stay with us at home while so she could go visit him in hospital. He cured, kidney stones got better, and he went home. When he came out of hospital, he said to me, "You must have to pay a lot of money for all this treatment I have." To know it's all our National Health Service, you come as a visitor, you get treatment for same as anybody else. So he was very impressed with this, because if this had happened to him in the States, he would have cost him thousands of dollars. Anyhow, I said, the only thing you can do is buy a box of chocolates for the nurses to look after, which he did.
Well,
he always remembers that.
I had my first baby on National Health over there in 1954.
Good.
Spring of 1954 on National Health.
That's a bit cheaper than having a baby here.
Yes.
As I say, John Sullivan was working on horse.
Well, then when you went back after ABS, what work were you involved in at that point? Were you still going on with the freezing of...
I moved into, I've been working on the development of insemination in pigs. That was something that hadn't really got off the ground in any country. And a lot of work on synchronization of estrus, control of ovulation time, and so forth. Using mainly the pig as a model.
Mm-hmm. I've mentioned that in here because they tried to synchronize the cow herds, and that's where the birth control,
pill. That's another thing. It's the other way around, actually. The synchronization technology with progestins, oral reactive progestins, and so forth, where you could feed these compounds to animals, came from the birth control. Human birth control.
Came from humans, so I got it the wrong way around?
Yep.
Oh boy, that's a good thing to catch.
Because progesterone had been used for trying to control ovulation in animals. But the development of an orally active progesterone was by these companies who wanted to develop a pill for the human. And on the back of that animal scientists could use these orally active progestins to try to control estrous cycles in farm animals.
But has that not been too successful?
No, because they tend to not be cleared from the body very quickly, and fertility can be affected with sperm transport and fertilization with these progestin compounds. So the prostaglandins came in. And a lot of those developments of the use of synthetic prostaglandins and so forth came from work in the UK. Those were relatively successful in cattle. And some of the more modern devices use implantable progestins, subcutaneous ones, or ones that can be delivered with devices that can be stuck into the vagina of an animal and withdrawn. So there's not so much of these compounds being fed at the human birth control in animal species. And estrous synchronization in cattle breeding isn't used to really a very great extent. That's why I was interested more in talk that one of these guys was giving the papers this morning.
The one right after you
was on the pedometers and things like that. Because one of the drawbacks to artificial insemination is the inaccuracy of heat detection in animal breeding. It's never really been overcome. And some of my colleagues have said, well, one of the biggest lifts to the efficiency of AI could be more accurate detection of estrus. Some of these technologies that he was describing have been around a fair time. Could really add to this.
Mm-hmm.
Good practical. I thought that was good practical paper.
Yeah. I dozed for a moment or two. I was hoping he wasn't referring to me in the section about the electrical resistance section, which I think was his third point. But I thought I'd ask him about it at some point, either call him up or I don't know if I'll see him today. Because I discovered all that when I was up at IABS a year ago at Christmas. Matt Dietrich took me through a kind of museum that they had set up there with all sorts of things, and they had the chin ball marker where the bull would scribble on the cow, and so we went into that whole estrus business of the cycles and so forth. And I must have got it wrong about the birth control pill coming from the cows to the humans, but
most humans stuff is based on animal work originally, so a lot of the work on controlling the relation times of humans was done using laboratory animals, rats and mice and rabbits. So the animal work was done first, and then the oral reactive substances were done for the human system, and then it came back into the animal, particularly these sorts of applications that people were trying to get in farm animals. Came after that time. I referred to coming over in 67 to work with an old colleague of mine, M.C. Chang. Well, M.C. Chang was working at the Worcester Foundation for Experimental Biology with somebody called Pincus. And Pincus and Chang are the people that did all the basic work on the human oral contraception. So it's quite interesting. Chang came from China, and his spiritual home was always in Cambridge, because he'd come to Cambridge and done his PhD in Cambridge, and then in 1945 or 46 came over to work in the States.
And so you knew him at Cambridge? You knew him at Cambridge then, before?
I didn't know him, because I didn't I wasn't on the scene.
You were a little later than.
I was still at university in 46. But Chang used to come back. I think I first met him at a meeting in England in about 51 or 52. I struck off a good friendship. And Chang used to love to come back to Cambridge.
Well, is he still alive? Is he?
No, he's dead. Mm-hmm. He died a few years ago. Quite a lot of these guys that I met in the early 50s as young scientists working on reproduction of farm animals, most of those still alive.
Mm-hmm.
Ed Graham from Minnesota, unfortunately, he did a lot of work on basic work on swimming freezing. He died a few years ago. He got brain cancer, which is sad. But many of these other ones are still around. Some of them have been at this meeting.
Mm-hmm.
John Armquist, seaman production pools, he was working in the late 40s, early 50s. I knew him way after in Penn State. Glenn Salisbury, I think perhaps he's dead.
I think he is.
Salisbury was involved in some of the early work on C. mandiluans. Very important thing with the development of the early expansion of AI was suitable media in which to dilute the sperm so that they could be kept for a day or two to go around the farms.
Mm-hmm.
So the principle of being able to cool the sperm and to have a diluent which would help the sperm survive being chilled to a refrigerated temperature and to maintain the life of the sperm for a day or two. That was very important work.
And he was at Illinois, wasn't he? Glenn Salisbury?
Yeah.
And that's where you came for your sabbatical? Or you were there?
Yeah, well, he was in the dairy science department. I came to the genetics department there to work with another guy called Phil Jack, because our interests were in pinks and the development of various things like embryo transplantation and migration of embryos and things in pigs. So that was where our mutual interest came about. Phil, I had met in 1953. He's a little bit older than I am, but he'd been in the war, had been drafted. So his university career was put back a bit.
Mm-hmm.
So he was just finishing his PhD when I came over in 53.
Mm-hmm.
I'd already been working for about 4 or 5 years in research.
So do you have any further suggestions for me on what I should put in here, or do you think I've covered the area fairly well, or?
I think it's good reading. I think it's pretty well researched, I think. And,
I'm not trying to tell the whole story of it because that would take a big fat book to tell the whole story of it.
No one knows the whole story.
What?
No one knows.
No one knows the whole story, and I'm trying to tell it from the point of view
of
Rock County and how that fits in, and how, I mean, I have my focus.
I'm sure it's all true, because this idea of the concept of truth is what people see through their own eyes at a certain time.
Mm-hmm.
And different people could observe the same thing around about the same time and have a different interpretation, because it's all true. Their interpretation, another person's interpretation, might be slightly different. It's just as true one as the other, even though there might be some little conflicts.
Well, that's good to know. To know your view on that. Yeah. I've quoted my father as saying, "You never spoil a good story for the facts," but but in certain things, I try to get the facts. My stories, I sometimes have taken considerable liberty with, but the. But this sort of thing, I'm trying to make as accurate as it can be.
Right, I should try.
You
and
should
get
back,
you,
yeah.
I'm really semi-retired now. I don't do so much to these scientific meetings because I can't do so much application and not learn.
Coming up. Well, I probably won't stay for any more of the sessions. Would you like my happy hour tickets? That would give you 6 instead of 3.
Well, for drink?
Yeah.
Does each one count as a drink?
I think so.
Well, I never turned down that.
Then you can pass them out too to others.
Yeah, my wife might be around, so give her one.
Let's see, what did I do with them? Right here, I think. No, that's not it. Here's one. Here's 3.
Oh, they're different colors.
Free drink, courtesy of Brooklyn Tool. There's a free drink courtesy
yellow,
of Sherben
green.
Manufacturing. And here's a free drink courtesy of IMV International. Okay, there's 3 more.
Good girl.
Free drinks.
Yeah. Mm. I'll swap those for these reprints that you might be interested in.
Okay, and I'll go out to the car and get you my my stories that were published in the Tri-Quarterly, which is a Northwestern literary magazine. And those are, most of them are my father when he was a boy, but then there's one of me. And I've got, of course I've got loads and loads and loads of these. One of my more fun ones is when I learned the facts of life by being explained them by the artificial inseminator. And
yeah.
And
Merwin? Yes. Mm. Yeah, just checking to make sure we got the right one, dude. Okay, cool.
And of course it keeps growing and growing is the thing. But, I keep finding more things.